The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
So yeah, thanks again for being here, everyone. It's really nice to see you. And for anyone who came in a little late, I'll introduce myself again. I'm Gabe Keller Flores, and been coming here for about 16 years. Just really happy to be here. I lead the weekly practice group sometimes when the guiding teachers are gone. So Shelley Graff is teaching out west right now, so really happy to be filling in. Thanks for meditating. And was sort of loosely trying to bring in some themes around non-clinging, which is a pretty central topic in Buddhism. And obviously there's different practices that can support non-clinging. So that's a little bit about what I want to talk about. And I sort of want to frame it as non-clinging as an avenue or a support for happiness. So to kind of put it in a positive light. And maybe to think of non-clinging less as something that we do and more of something that we can get a taste for, so what non-clinging feels like, because it's sort of kind of a abstract concept, you know? It's like if someone were to tell us to stop clenching our fists, that would be pretty easy to understand. But in terms of the mind, you know, non-clinging in the mind, it's a little bit, it's kind of subtle. And so maybe it's helpful to, think of it less as something that we do, both clinging and non-clinging, and more something we can be interested in, that with mindfulness, we can sort of have the, maybe the right kind of level of attunement or of perception to even pick up what is this clinging, this non-clinging, whereas in daily life, just going about our duties and responsibilities, we may not have the sensitivity to really, get a sense of what those words are pointing to. And that's a lot of what our practice is that sensitizing, just because, we tend to, we have most of us, a lot going on and in our lives and in the world, and it's just easy to get by on habit. So mindfulness is really that capacity to know our experience in a more direct way, in a way that doesn't exclude concepts, because the mind, sort of just what the mind does is think. In Buddhism, we talk about it as the sixth sense door. So just like the eyes see, the mind thinks. But we tend to be kind of live in that world. And so, clinging is not a thought. Clinging is an activity of the mind. It's sort of a stance of the mind. So to get interested in it in that direct way, we sort of have to have that level of mindfulness that is sensitive to that mental activity, which is, it may manifest in a number of different ways, clinging to this, clinging to that. In Buddhism, there's a list of five types of things that we cling to in general, which I don't need to go into, but you can probably fill in the blank for yourself. Different parts of our experience that we grab hold of and take personally and then get tight about, So a lot of the teachings on being free, being at peace, are less about a particular activity that we do, do this, follow these steps, and then you will arrive at peace, but more about an absence of some stressful activity in the mind, like clinging. So it's kind of paradoxical, can feel in some ways like, just tell me what to do. That's what, you know, a lot of us, we can be good at doing. But this getting interested in non-clinging may be a more helpful way to frame it, as opposed to trying to stop ourselves from clinging or trying to do non-clinging. But, you know, the perspective of mindfulness, the practice of mindfulness, as anyone who's tried it knows, is sort of frustrating in how counter to so much of that doing conditioning. You know, it's like, it's a receptive mode, we often say, you know, and it's characterized by that interest, and it's an interest that kind of doesn't know what it's looking for in a way. You know, we can be interested in, you know, finding out the answer to some question we have, you know, especially these days with our phones. I don't know about you, but I can be kind of an addict when it comes to finding out something I want to know. But in terms of just being receptive to the moment as it is, in order to release that habit of clinging to whatever it is, you know, that's a very different mode that we kind of put aside time for, like meditation time for, because it's a skill that most of us haven't developed. You know, it'd be interesting, like with kids, if in kindergarten or something, there was just this time, like, we're just going to take these 5 minutes and we're just going to sit and we're just going to be, and we're going to be present and aware and relaxed, but we're not going to do anything. And we're not going to try to make anything happen or try to be anyone. I'm just going to sit in a relaxed way. And maybe the one instruction would be to enjoy that, just to enjoy sitting. You know, and what a different training that would be than just, we're going to teach you all these different ways to apply your mind and solve problems, which, of course, we all need to do. But just in terms of this different orientation and exploration of something more immediate, like how to be happy, we may not have... we may not have a lot, just to be humble and to be honest, we may not have a lot of skill in that, right? As that quote by, I think it's Nietzsche, all the problems, all of humanity's problems stem from our inability to sit quietly in a room alone. Because it's like from that, you know, that antsiness and that inability to just not, just for a time, period of time, to not cling, to not be in that mode of trying to make stuff happen, then we kind of jump to the assumption, well, that doesn't work, so I've got to make stuff happen. And often our attempts to make stuff happen, our attempts to be happy, our attempts to deal with the discomfort that we feel can just kind of further that, because we may be clinging to some idea that is kind of once a step too far, sort of assuming something like, I'm uncomfortable and that's because I don't have this in my life, or I'm too this or whatever. And then we go about trying to solve that problem without even kind of addressing that first assumption, like that this clinging is sort of real, that this is a real thing. And obviously there are real problems and there are real things we need to do in life. But do we need to internally clench about them? Is it possible to live our lives, take care of our responsibilities, engage in the richness and the dance of life without clinging, without stress? And that's really the question that's at the heart of the Buddha's teaching. And it's a pretty radical idea. So I don't think we should believe that, but I would think that it's an interesting idea. One of my teachers, Ajahn Suchitto, monk, he's been a monk for a long time, maybe almost 50 years, wonderful teacher, and I like something he's been saying a lot recently, which is clinging, which is that clinging is a reflex. It's not a decision. So I think that's helpful because it, you know, we in Buddhism, again, like with everything, we tend to take in information and then create ideals and then try to live up to ideals in ways that can be helpful, can be useful, but also can be stressful because they're ideals and it's hard to live up to ideals. So we can hear about non-clinging and think we have to not cling. But if clinging is a reflex, then it's more about being interested. So again, this perspective of mindfulness, like, what is this clinging reflex? How does it arise? When does it not arise? And I think this is a potentially a much more easeful approach. And one way I want to frame it is maybe instead of being so interested in trying to avoid clinging, trying to avoid suffering, be a good Buddhist, for those of us who kind of really, really get a lot out of the Buddhist teachings, instead we could follow whatever taste of peace and freedom, however subtle, however small, or however infrequent those moments are, but sort of follow that taste of non-clinging. Those moments, I remember Mark, one of the guiding teachers, would talk about often, like, as an example, like you getting home from a long day of work and maybe just you just lay down on your bed and it's just like just that happiness of putting things down for that moment. So whatever these moments are where there is that happiness of non-clinging, and they may be more frequent than we think. One teacher, I think it was Ajahn Buddhadasa, a Thai forest monk, has a talk, I think you can look it up, called Nibbana for Everyone. So Nibbana is sort of the final goal in early Buddhism. And the word literally means cessation. And so he was kind of trying to take this concept, which can be kind of elevated and reified, kind of turned into this mystical, metaphysical thing, and saying, well, maybe Nibbana, these moments of cessation, are a lot more common than we might notice if we're not being mindful. You know, with every obsession that arises in our mind, there's a moment in which it ceases. And there's this image of sort of a monkey in the jungle grabbing one branch, and it lets go of one branch, but then it immediately grabs another branch. And that's often what our mind is. And that's kind of what we think life is, a day is. And it can really be that. But maybe it's less about trying to, you know, get the monkey to stop grabbing branches, because that just may be another branch we're trying to, you know, could just get kind of contorted. But just noticing, maybe just with mindfulness, if we notice the pleasure and the happiness of any of those moments of cessation, maybe just because we're interested in pleasure naturally, we're interested in peace and happiness, maybe that can be an incentive and an interest that, yeah, is positive in that sense. Just getting a taste for the happiness of non-clinging. And I think that's part of it, is that it is a kind of happiness, but it's a different kind of happiness than the happiness of gratification, which is mostly what we're familiar with and mostly what is, sort of talked about and promoted. So the happiness of letting go, the happiness of cessation. It is a kind of happiness, but there's, another teacher, Ajahn Sumedho, says people like the idea of peace, but we may need to get maybe a cultivated taste, or a taste that we, because there's an openness to it. It's not defined in the sense that gratification is, or, you know, having some ego trip is, but there's no stress there. So it's kind of more about the absence of what's there. You know, it's like taking a heavy backpack off. So whatever moments we can sort of notice that just in ordinary moments, I think that is how we get interested in that flavor, that particular flavor, and then maybe see how applicable that is to our life, you know, and how many arenas of our life might that be, be applicable. Do we need to be tight when in this situation or in that situation, being engaged, you know, doing the things we have to do? Do we need to be tight internally? And it's a good question, and it's one we can really only answer directly for ourselves. But just to start by having some, just some interest in that quality, so that there's going to be other kinds of practices that are maybe more obvious and we can engage in, like being careful with our conduct to not cause harm, you know, to act in ways that doesn't leave a feeling of remorse. You know, this is a big part of kind of stabilizing the mind so that it's less caught up with remorse and just feeling like, just all the ways that we can fill our minds with distraction and ways that kind of leave us a little bit spinning, right? There's just so much stimulation too in modern life, and it's really, the most richest companies in the world really understand our brains and how they're wired and really are doing everything they can to grab our attention and kind of just put us in a dazed state. But we can learn, if we're mindful, again, about what that's like, you know, what the effect is of spending this much time on my phone or whatever it might be. So a lot of practices in Buddhism are sort of stabilizing the mind so that it's more sensitive, so that it can feel these more subtle distinctions, clinging and non-clinging, you know, a heart, you know, the peace of letting go of cessation. There kind of needs to be some stability of mind to even kind of, be sensitive enough to notice these. For the most part, and that's where a lot of practices like this being careful with our conduct, but also more proactive or positive practices like generosity and being interested in ill will in our hearts, all the ways we justify ill will. So these kind of more, you could say, relational practices, which all day long, you know, We still do need mindfulness, so it's not like it's one first and then the other. They actually need a lot of mindfulness to be aware in relationships. But it's a little more concrete, like I don't need to, I can be aware of my actions. You know, I could be very careful with my actions and not, you know, speaking harshly or speaking ill of other people. But I could still, you know, be thinking those thoughts. So it's kind of different levels. But it does pay off to be careful on that level. And it sort of points to our minds, you know, to be careful with my conduct, then I have to be aware of the intentions arising in my mind. And so the idea with a lot of those practices, it is about, kind of cultivating the supportive conditions for a mind that's basically happier. It's interesting, one monk I was many years ago at a monastery in California, Abhayagiri, which is in this tradition, the Thai forest tradition. Several teachers I've mentioned are in this tradition. And he was giving a talk, a monk there, and just kind of summarized a point that I think I'm getting at here, where often people will come to meditation because they're unhappy, because we're unhappy. And he said it's maybe in some ways the teachings on happiness are often involving sort of these more concrete things, you know, like if we live in ways that we basically feel good about, doing our best to not cause harm, to be sensitive, to be generous, you know, to not be stingy, to kind of do what we can as a human being and community. Those are real sources of happiness that are talked about. And then the idea is you sit down, you know, having done your best in a day to not cause harm, and looking back on that, feeling pretty good. Obviously, you know, it's not about being perfect, but just that sensitivity. Then the idea is the rest kind of happens on its own from that feeling of the mind being happy to some degree. Then it's a more sensitive instrument. So much of what keeps our mind distracted, right, and not wanting to be in the present moment is just all that agitation that's there. But we've probably all experienced moments where there's just, you know, maybe just a really nice interaction with a friend, and it's just like a lot of happiness, feeling connected, and there's just, you know, maybe a little more settledness there, like, can just kind of sit and be. I want to read a teaching that is talking about this as the naturalness of the development towards freedom, making this point that there is effort required, but a lot of the effort, we could think of it maybe more of kind of, refraining, like with our conduct, refraining from unskillful impulses. But then once there's a certain kind of stability, a lot can sort of happens on its own, which can be nice to hear because, you know, again, with meditation, if we're coming, you know, to meditation, like, my life's a mess, I'm so agitated, I'm going to sit down and get my mind in order, like, that may just be a war. But if we're sort of, doing our best to be sensitive, careful, you know, feeling some degree of stability, then we sit down, and things maybe just continue that settling process. So I'm just going to jump and read. So this is from the early teachings. It's a discourse called the Discourse on the Volition Not to Be Done. This is great, right? We're so geared towards doing. This is the discourse on the volition not to be done. So what we don't need to do. But it starts with, for a virtuous person. So this is sort of like, there is some work for most of us when we come to being mindful, you know, and we hear about the precepts, which are these areas to bring attention to. There's a fair amount of work in just sort of, if this is a value for me to not cause harm, to be careful, there's kind of no end to that. But there's a certain amount of just applying ourselves that we can, you know, we can see the results from that. So anyways, I'll read about the, how things move on naturally from this point. So bhikkhus means practitioners. Bhikkhus, for a virtuous person, one whose behavior is virtuous, no volition need be exerted. Let non-regret arise in me. It is natural that non-regret arises in a virtuous person, one whose behavior is virtuous. For one without regret, no volition need be exerted. Let gladness arise in me. It is natural that gladness arises in one without regret. And then it goes on in a similar way. It is natural that joy arises in one who is glad. It is natural that the body becomes tranquil in one whose mind is joyful. It is natural to feel happiness in one whose body is tranquil. It is natural that the mind becomes concentrated in one who feels happiness. It is natural that someone who is concentrated knows and sees things as they are. It is natural that one who knows and sees things as they are is disenchanted and dispassionate. It is natural that one who is disenchanted and dispassionate realizes knowledge and vision of liberation. So there's, you know, this is, all of those are going through this refrain, no volition need be exerted, it's natural. So, and there's a lot of teachings like this of the flowing on of the deepening of understanding and letting go and peace and happiness as a natural occurrence that just, you know, when the conditions are there, it kind of flows on. And there's images given in that respect, like of water from pools up on the mountain, you know, it fills up one pool and then the water flows down to another pool. Gil Fronsdal, who I'm doing this 8-month course with, is emphasizing this point about the naturalness, and talks about how a lot of the metaphors for sort of suffering are more things that are constructed, like a house that's constructed, you know, and we can kind of think of that in our own minds, you know, just how much we can construct and invent. But the movement towards freedom and liberation being more of a natural one. So I think this is just an interesting perspective, because it's, we can just be so primed to think, you know, happiness, peace is something that I'm going to do, I'm going to get. But maybe it's not that there isn't effort required, but maybe it's more like avoiding the clinging, the different kinds of clinging. You could think of that as sort of stones or impediments in a flow. So that's one example where this discourse starts with for a virtuous person. And there's other similar teachings where there's some sort of initiating condition and then everything else flows on. Like one is abandoning the hindrances. So that's, you know, that's a lot of our practice, you know, when we sit in meditation. Like I was saying towards the end, like to just give ourselves to one thing is such a useful practice, because in order to be with breathing, we need to put aside, you know, worrying about this, planning about that. So there is, it does take effort, but maybe from that point of sort of whatever degree we sort of access that, you know, abandoning the hindrances or virtuous conduct, or guarding the sense doors is another one, which I think of as sort of just kind of understanding that from our conditioned mind, the world is kind of like full of potential triggers, potential sort of. So it's just useful to sort of be aware of that. And it's not, guarding the sense doors doesn't mean shutting our senses, but being aware of how we sort of are touched by the senses and more about our relationship to the senses. So there's, you know, there's a lot of practices where we can be active. You know, these sort of, with mindfulness, there's often images of sort of like a guard at an entrance. So there's like kind of this vigilance sometimes is a word that's used. So we're awake, we're aware, we're interested. You know, we're trying to be aware of what's skillful, what's not skillful. And then maybe at a certain point, you know, we've done a good job. The guard has done a good job. You know, there's kind of, oh yeah, that's not helpful, it's not needed. And maybe things settle down a little bit. And maybe that's then, with that taste of peace or freedom, we can kind of enjoy that. And just like that teaching says, the more we sort of feel that, let that register, those different kinds of happiness and peace that come through not clinging in those ways. Maybe that just kind of can lead on and it's on its own. Again, sort of like a river will just continue to flow if there aren't those impediments. So maybe this is a helpful perspective, because we can tune in when if we have any access or any sense of that peace, which again may be more available than we might think. It doesn't have to be like complete peace, but just any moment of cessation. The mind puts something down, and we can learn to tune into that and to orient around that, you know, to kind of be on the lookout for that, that taste of peace. And then maybe, you know, maybe it's more available. And then maybe once we tune into it, it's more a matter of staying with it, being interested in it, seeing where it goes, then, okay, now I've got it. I've got to cling to it or think about it a lot. And I think this can be helpful too in terms of just kind of how we think about our practice and ourselves from maybe a more positive, maybe it's a more positive view, kind of building on success in a way, like Ajahn Chah, an important teacher in the Thai forest tradition, said once something that's always stuck with me, that you can't cry forever. And I like it because I feel like, I'm just kind of inferring what he meant. But it's true. So just like, even if there is a lot of crying, but then that moment when it ceases, you know, just sometimes you need a good cry, and then it's like, that flavor of that peace. Well, you know, that's something to pay attention to. So yeah, I think for me, you know, there's these different personality types, so-called, in Buddhism. Sometimes we like to talk about of more like if you're more aversive or more greedy or more deluded, confused. And I'm definitely more aversive. So it's very easy for me reading the teachings, you know, like, oh yeah, this is very clear, makes a lot of sense, know what to do. But it can just be sort of another way of evaluating myself and, you know, judging myself for not meeting these expectations. But to just appreciate whatever moments of peace or harmony or, you know, happiness are present is a different kind of approach. Yeah, to just start there and build from there. So this is kind of abstract, right? Like I was saying, there's a certain amount of sensitivity to feel, you know, what peace, happiness, these words are pointing to. And I think, you know, we can get maybe more of a sense of it in meditation where we're putting everything else aside. And, you know, we could think of that as really what we're interested in, is whatever degree of peace, happiness is present, feeling that, settling into that. So maybe in meditation, we can get a little more of a taste for it. And then maybe once we have some taste of it, and again, I think this is part of the path, is just deepening that understanding of what that experience is of non-clinging. So it's not like you experience it once and you're done. But I think the more we have a sense of that and how good it feels, how it's a kind of happiness that doesn't have any side effects. It's a kind of happiness that doesn't seem to take anything away, doesn't seem to be limited by conditions. Then we can be interested, when we're not meditating, in the different arenas of our life. What would non-clinging look like here? What would the happiness of being at ease with conditions look like here? And I think that's where there's a lot of learning and a lot of, everything in our relationships and our livelihood, where again, it's not coming from a place of, oh, a good Buddhist would look like this or wouldn't react. It's more usually like, I am reacting. This, you know, there is this suffering, this stress, and being interested in that. And just having that question, like, is to not assume that that is, it doesn't, it, again, it's a reflex, not a decision. So it's not about judging ourselves. But once we've had some experiences of peace or happiness, and a peace and happiness that's, you could say, maybe more, feels more internal, then it's kind of like, yeah, taking it on the road in a sense. You know, in, and that's where some of these practices, like there's a list of the 10 paramis, 10 perfections or virtues. I think where they're sort of helpful is getting us to question any assumption we might have, like just an example, like being in traffic and feeling impatient and feeling like that's just kind of, there's no other option. But these paramis sort of are sort of a positive description maybe of what non-clinging might look like in different situations. So like generosity involves non-clinging because we're letting go of something. We're saying, well, maybe there's a happiness greater than holding on to this, which would be to share it. Morality or integrity is like, again, sort of letting go of just getting our way, but there's something that would be more fulfilling, more happy than that, which is to be sensitive, to be respectful. And I won't go through all of them, but it's a wonderful list, the 10 paramis. So again, I think part of why I'm bringing this up is to think, because that non-clinging can be abstract, but our lives aren't abstract. So what, you know, what this orientation may support, may allow for, you know, can look all sorts of different ways. It doesn't, non-clinging doesn't tell us what to do in our life, which we may want it to, but it's more like this active investigation, which is what I think, yeah, makes it really interesting. And it's, again, like even the word non-clinging could be confusing. But more, you know, it's that sense of, not sort of getting tight, getting constricted, getting fixated, getting stuck. What does that look like when dealing with the complexity of life? And I don't think it's just, you know, that we're a pushover and we just do what anyone else says. It's that, like, engagement, but does there, just that, maybe that question, like, does there need to be this doubling down, is fixating, no, it's my way or the highway or whatever, whether it's with other people or with ourselves, or is there a way of engaging, being intimate with life that still kind of keeps that openness? And maybe that's actually where a lot of creativity can come from. You know, if we're not clinging, say, to like a fixed view of ourselves, or, you know, I'm always like this. Yeah, I'm just always like that. So, you know, that's my life. Like, I'm that person. I'm the aversive person, or I'm the fearful person. Just got to live my life now. Got to act out that script. I think we can, to be honest, we can take some comfort in those identities, even if they're painful identities, but at least we kind of know who we are, or, you know, have that script. But you know, there may be more possibility for different options that feel more free, more happy. So that's one thing we can think about with this topic and happiness, because we tend to think of happiness as something we get. And there certainly are, you know, it's nice to have pleasant sense experiences. But this internal happiness, we could say like internal freedom, maybe it's more about what isn't there than what's there, which is what makes it, more applicable, you know, in different situations. So that could be a question we ask too, like when we imagine what we're interested in or what we're looking for. Maybe it's more, this absence of all the ways that we feel constricted, that we feel limited, that we feel boxed in, and what, you know, ways where that just, it's not even that our conditions change, our personality becomes completely different, but that sense of being oppressed, being limited, I think this is one of the fruits of practice, that there's just, and it's kind of hard to even explain how it happens, but I think it's through that getting to know that flavor of peace and happiness, of the mind not doing that very habitual thing, activity of clinging, where then it just becomes more accessible. Like, oh no, this is maybe actually a functional orientation, a functional, like the personality, the, you know, being a human being can still sort of take care of itself, and maybe can even take care of itself in more creative, nimble ways. You know, it's kind of unthinkable in some ways from just our habitual ways of thinking that could be possible. But I think we get tastes of it, right? Like when life feels like a joy, feels effortless, when we're just happy to be engaging in whatever it is. You know, even work, like, you know, we all have to go to work and earn a living. And we can just, I mean, and obviously there's a lot of exploitation that can be involved and things aren't fair. So we're justified in feeling put upon in many ways. But just to be, just to be interested in any way that we're kind of owning that or taking that on in whatever way, you know, that life is a chore, kind of that have that as just like a fundamental worldview. You know, life is a lot of work, which it is, but haven't we ever enjoyed working? Like all the things, like probably the moments when we've had a lot of fun in our life, you know, like play is work too, you know. I make music, and the best, you know, experiences of that are, it's definitely like there's engagement, but it's kind of engagement without attachment, maybe. That's kind of what we call play. So again, this isn't like an ideal to try to necessarily compare ourselves to, that all of our life would feel joyful and feel like play. But what are the intentions that feel like that? That feel like, it's not that we're not engaged, you know, like, again, this is where positive virtues like compassion or generosity, I think part of what they do, for me at least, is they point to a kind of happiness that's engaged, and that, you know, you could say involves work or involves, but that is happy, you know. So that happiness, even non-clinging, isn't dependent on non-engagement or just being quiet. And that's what, you know, makes it a really, I think, interesting, sort of description of a way of living, of an orientation. So maybe I'll just read a few more things and then open it up, see what questions or thoughts you have. But I think part of what I was trying to get at is just maybe getting away from an idea of that there's just one way, there's a fixed set of things you do and then you arrive at non-clinging, but more, this felt sense that we can get in touch with and then sort of follow that felt sense of non-clinging. And so it may be more of a heart thing, of a heart feeling, like feeling good. We all want to feel good. And where do we feel that? So I'll read this little story. This is from Gil Fronsdahl, who I've mentioned and teaches in California at Insight Meditation Center. And he wrote this little story. And it starts with an engineer who comes to want to meditate and is really intent, knows that, yeah, this is definitely the path. Really, this is going to help me solve my problems, my mental stress. But he's just not having success, just really getting frustrated, but is really committed. So the abbess of this monastery, this is what she says to him. For 2 years, I want you to volunteer 10 hours a week at the maternity ward at the local hospital. The hospital needs people to hold babies who are born prematurely. If they don't receive enough physical contact, the babies will not grow healthily. When you have finished these 2 years, please come back to see me. The man was quite perplexed by this instruction, but because of his trust in the abbess, he plunged into volunteering in the maternity ward. He was amazed at how small and fragile the babies were that he held. He would hold them ever so carefully. He would watch their every breath because they all seemed in danger of stopping to breathe. He spent a lot of time thinking about how he could more effectively care for the babies he held, but there was nothing more effective than simply holding them against his chest. After about 6 months, he started feeling something quite new. He started to feel a little spot of warmth and softness in the very center of his being. Since this was quite a foreign experience that didn't fit any of the ways he thought about himself, he ignored it. Ignoring it was the best thing he could have done because it prevented him from interfering with the warmth. Over the following months, this tender spot grew. As it did, the cold, dark wall he had in his heart slowly relaxed, thawed, and dissolved. When he had completed his 2 years in the maternity ward, the engineer returned to the monastery. The abbess saw immediately that he was a changed man. He was no longer desperate, and he was no longer trying to fit everything into a conceptual framework. Giving him new instruction, the abbess said to him, "When you meditate, don't be aware by thinking about what is happening. Rather, let your attention arise out of the tenderness you feel in your body. If you do this, any meditation practice you do will be fruitful." The man found that this proved to be true. I just really like this. We're such a heady society in general, and meditation circles can be very heady. But what we're interested in, I think, at least what I'm interested in, is not a concept, as much as I like concepts, but they're not as satisfying as those moments of peace, connection, warmth, whatever it is. And so to kind of, start from there. No, we can't always start from there, but to kind of maybe be a little bit more fluid, a little bit more open about that this is kind of coming from that place. And we probably all have different ways of accessing that place too. So just to be creative, to not think there's just one way or it has to fit the Buddhist words and concepts, but what feels like freedom, what feels like peace and happiness and joy, and then, feel that and let that have its effect. Okay, I'll end with a poem by Naomi Shihab Nye, the American Palestinian poet that gets read often in Buddhist circles. This is called "So Much Happiness." It is difficult to know what to do with so much happiness. With sadness, there's something to rub against, a wound to tend with lotion and cloth. When the world falls in around you, you have pieces to pick up, something to hold in your hands, like ticket stubs or change. But happiness floats. It doesn't need you to hold it down. It doesn't need anything. Happiness lands on the roof of the next house, singing, and disappears when it wants to. You are happy either way. Even the fact that you once lived in a peaceful treehouse and now live over a quarry of noise and dust cannot make you unhappy. Everything has a life of its own. It too could wake up filled with possibilities of coffee cake and ripe peaches and love even the floor which needs to be swept, the soiled linens and scratched records. Since there is no place large enough to contain so much happiness, you shrug, you raise your hands, and it flows out of you into everything you touch. You are not responsible. You take no credit, as the night sky takes no credit for the moon, but continues to hold it and share it, and in that way be known. So maybe happiness is much bigger than our usual thoughts, conceptions of it. So I'll leave you with that. Thanks for listening. Appreciate your kind attention. And we have some time if people have any questions about anything I've shared or maybe your own experiences, moments of happiness, even in the midst of life and messiness, being nice to hear. Any testimonials? What comes to mind for people? We'll use the mic if you don't mind.
I'm Kathleen. I was thinking that clinging is a form of like habit energy. So all of us judge people, it's just human nature. And I can be pretty judgy. And one of the things that I've noticed is you judge people by how they look, by what they say, whether they're different than we are. And I've noticed that how I can stop clinging to that. Like I can, it's an instantaneous thing that happens, but I don't like stay with it. I don't cling to it anymore. I mean, I do sometimes, but it's just that I've noticed with my practice that that's something that is more of an absence now.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, I like how you described it. Yeah, please. Just going to make one comment that I liked how you described it, that it wasn't through, you know, judging yourself that there was more space, but just through, oh, this is just, like you said, maybe who knows why, but a human tendency. And it's kind of like, oh, big deal after a while, maybe, and more space or something. That's at least what I heard. Thanks. Yes, please.
I like your analogy of the sky holding the moon. It reminds me of a conversation I had recently on happiness or freedom. And that conversation resonated with what you said, and I just wanted to share that. It was something that the word we'd use is like additive, isn't happy, but subtractive is. Because it's whatever it is that is being described feels like something that isn't what comes in and leaves. It's whatever is what holds what comes and leaves. So it's less of an additional thing. And I think that's where the sort of way we use happiness is typically like it's an additive, it's like a pleasure experience that comes and goes. But it seems like that poem what you said is much deeper. That's all I have about.
Appreciate that a lot. Thank you. Yeah, isn't it just kind of second nature for most of us to think of happiness as something we'll get? Maybe we'll never get happiness. What would happiness look like if it wasn't something that we get?
Say that question again.
Oh, I just said, what would happiness look like if it's not something that we get? And one thing, just another thought, to jump off of that, there's a teacher, James Barres, in California, who has this whole course on awakening joy, and he has a book on it too. And I think it's him who made this point, or maybe it was Mark, but something about like the word joy we often use, don't use in that same way. We're like, we don't often say, I think, that, oh, that made me joyful, like reading that book made me joyful, or it's joy, I think that word tends to have more of that sense of like kind of an internal experience. So it's mysterious. Where does that come from? Thanks for sharing. Time for one or two more. People want to share experiences of joy or happiness.
I was closing my eyes and imagining that poem. I realized how much I miss peaches. but I want to say, starting in 2023, finding this place, and also my friends, like a lot of them are here. I love you guys so much. There's like this deep sense of joy like you were talking about. And to go back to another analogy you had, it was the water flowing down the mountain. It feels very unforced. It's not like additive in the sense that like we don't need to keep doing things. Some of our like best joys are when we're like just quiet, surrounding each other and feeling this like added thing that we can't point to. And we all notice it though, and we can feel it. And then we acknowledge it, not even in words, and just like, it's really awesome. And I feel that here too a lot. So it's nice.
Thanks for sharing. Can you remind me of your name?
Ipsa.
Ipsa. Thanks, Ipsa. Yeah, the title of this talk I was thinking would be an orientation of non-clinging. So it's more of an orientation, and not super specific, not like one thing you do, but maybe something you're oriented to as a potential, you know, I don't know, value, and a life of richness, so that those two don't have to be, yeah, mutually exclusive. But what is the kind of, yeah, richness or value that arises, like, you know, a positive sense, sort of maybe what you were hinting at, but that isn't about somebody getting something, holding on to something. So that's, yeah, I think it's nice to think about the benefits, you know, maybe the richness that can come. I mean, yeah, that's been my experience. You know, a lot of letting go in different ways, a lot of it painful, you know, learning, oh, that doesn't work. But yeah, the in moments, that sense of the heart itself being more trustworthy, being just a, you know, a more pleasant companion, you know, this heart, that's a pretty valuable thing as opposed to all the other stuff. Well, thanks again. Really appreciate being here with everyone. Yeah, let's just take a moment, let go of the words, appreciate being together, and maybe sharing any benefit that's come from being together, reflecting, wishing that that be shared with our loved ones, with all who are struggling, and with all beings in all directions. May all beings be free from suffering and free from the causes of suffering.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.